a day like today. We sat in Washington Square Park, sipping wine from a Dixie cup, when Bert glimpsed Anatole Broyard walking past and said, he's one of us, but he doesn't want to admit he's one of us. Maybe it was guesswork, contorted into breath. We sat staring after Anatole until he disappeared down Waverly Place. Bird took a sip, shook his head and said, now that guy chases heartbreak more than I do.
On RN, you're with The Music Show, and I'm Andrew Ford, and we're going to be spending the next hour in the company of the composer of this music. Of course, that's the voice of Kurt Elling, I hardly need to tell you. Playing that lovely piano solo there is Lawrence Hobgood. Hamish Stewart is drumming. Jonathan Swartz, again, is the bass player. And the music is by Sandy Evans. Sandy Evans is simply one of the most important figures in Australian jazz today. She is, of course, a saxophone player and a composer, a band leader, a mentor, a role model, and she has a finger in many musical pies, lots of different collaborations. And we recorded a really long, good interview with her a couple of years ago. We've never repeated it. It's one of the best interviews, I think, that we've ever had on The Music Show. And we thought we would take the opportunity that is Australian Music Month to hear it again. So, Sandy Evans.
Maybe it was a day like today. We were over at Max's house as Bird talked Lenny before Bruce was heard of telling a story about a club owner's parrot squawking the magic word. Maybe it was sunny or cloudy with our tears, like other days when Max's mama slid her key into the front door lock. Bird would jump up, grab the Bible, and start thumbing through the pages. And Mrs. Roach would say, why aren't you all more like Charlie? Why aren't you more like Charlie?
That's A Day Like Today. We hear the voice of Kurt Elling, the piano of Lawrence Hobgood, Hamish Stewart on drums, and Jonathan Swartz on bass. And that was music by Sandy Evans, a tribute to Charlie Parker. And I'm very pleased to say that Sandy Evans joins me in the studio. Welcome to The Music Show again.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Thank you.
Well, let's start with Charlie Parker, shall we? I mean, we've talked before on this program about testimony. Was Charlie Parker a hero for you?
Yes, Charlie Parker was, but I've gone through different phases of degrees of identifying with him. I suppose, you know, as a saxophone player, it's like, you know, part of the canon of music that you have to learn, that you have to deal with. And certain times as a rebellious teenager, you sort of go, why do I have to do this? I want to do my own thing. And I've certainly been through a number of those phases with Charlie Parker, even though I always sort of went, wow, that is really extraordinary music. And then you sort of go through a phase where you realise, okay, that's why I have to look at that music, because it's going to teach me so much about how to play the saxophone, so much about how to invent beautiful lines through chord changes, a lot about the energy and the history of the music. So I've been through all those phases. But then when it came to actually writing Testimony, was a whole other experience again, because I was collaborating with the African-American poet Yusef Komunyakaa, and seeing the history of, you know, the bebop era through an African-American's eyes. And not only that, but someone who trusted me to respond to it in music, knowing full well that I was not at all like part of that tradition, in that I'm a white Australian woman living in Sydney. That was a very personal and very moving experience for me, where I came to appreciate a sort of transcendent quality, I think, in the beboppers, that even though there's a lot of anguish in that period of history and the music that came out of that, there's a sort of liberating, transcendent quality in the music that is what we all, I think, love when we listen to it, and what I tried to access in that particular piece. It's also very playful and very cheeky. That particular piece is a lot dealing with the sort of humour of the beboppers, which is also, you know, a great and wonderful thing, and something that jazz musicians still love to tap into.
Yes, it's always just beneath the surface in bebop, it seems to me, partly because it's bebop tends to be such clever music.
That's right. That's right. You've got to be very, very quick-witted. The best bebop players are just, yeah, very, very quick off the mark.
A few of them as fast as Charlie Parker was.
Absolutely.
You hear that torrent of ideas coming out of his saxophone.
It's still mind-blowing, I think, you know, and how he could have executed it so beautifully, even if he had a plastic alto,
yeah,
you know, or a mouthpiece he'd never ever played before, and he could be totally out of it on drugs, and still the ideas would come flowing out.
Well, you play tenor primarily and soprano,
yeah.
Although, I mean, I have heard you play alto, but what? How do you choose? How does a player choose which instruments to specialise on? Because almost every sax player does.
Yeah, that's right. Well, for me, it was quite a personal thing, actually. I had grown up playing flute. Then I did play alto. It was actually the first saxophone that I played. You know, it tends to be the one people have lying around in the school band room, and if you want to play a bit of sax, okay, you have a go on the alto. Then I think the actual experience that led me to want to play the tenor was hearing, I went to a play at the Ensemble Theatre, and I can't remember what the play was, but there was a tenor player on the soundtrack, and it was Jerry Bergonzi, I'm pretty sure with Dave Brubeck. And you know, you have those kind of those moments where you just hear a sound and you connect with it and you go, I want to make that sound. And that happened for me with that particular sound. I think it was also the depth, having a lower register, because my voice is high and I was playing the flute already, which was also, you know, very high, and sort of I felt like I wanted to get into deeper sound and a warmer, kind of richer middle, you know, kind of earthy sound. So that's how it happened for me with the tenor. With the soprano, was an equally sort of left field experience in a way, where after I left school, I went, did the sort of obligatory backpacking around Europe, and I was doing a bit of busking to keep myself, you know, earn a few extra dollars and things. I was in Paris, and outside Notre Dame, where they have all the people playing, and I heard a soprano player playing a bent soprano. And I just, same thing happened. I just went, that sound, I love that sound. And after that, I came home and I got a bent soprano. That was the first soprano I played. The same thing happened when I took up the flute. That was in primary school. And a boy had come to our class, and we'd got this big warning that we were going to have an older boy coming in, and that he had a problem. And his problem was dyslexia. not the fact that he played the flute. He came in and he played the flute so beautifully, and it was a magic moment. It was like an enchantment, the sound.
Is that still something that is important to you? Is it the sound that you go for in the recording studio? Is it the sound that attracts you to a particular instrument or voice?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely the sound.
The quality of the sound.
Yeah, totally. That's very much the first thing that I respond to and that I look for. And the amazing thing is that it's not the kind of thing that you tire of. It's not the sort of thing that you ever feel like, okay, I've achieved that, or I've discovered everything there is to know about sound. It's such a living entity. And when you hear a great player play, they're just making the sound come to life. And I think that's in any genre of music. You know, when you hear a great player, you connect to that actual sound that they make. It's interesting because at the moment I'm studying, and so I'm looking at ethnomusicology and discovering all sorts of stuff about the way people think about music that I never knew, you know. And there's this one, I'm sure you're very familiar with it, and some of your listeners probably are too, but this idea of three areas of music making: concept, behaviour and sound. And yeah, you're right. Yeah, sound is it for me. Yeah.
Yes. I'm talking to Sandy Evans on today's music show. She is a composer and she plays tenor and soprano saxophone. Was it the saxophone that led you to jazz then? Or from what you're saying, if you started out as a flute player, you probably wouldn't have been playing jazz. But by the time you get a saxophone in your hands, you know, you're really sort of being led in that direction, aren't you?
Yeah, I had a very mixed up sort of childhood in terms of music, where I got a lot of different influences, and that's probably set me up for the rest of my life, I suppose. And jazz actually was one of them, even from primary school, because we had at our school John Spate, the amazing man who started the Manly Jazz Festival, and he was a teacher at my primary school.
I see.
And he generated a big sort of scene in the northern beaches of Sydney from which a lot of jazz musicians grew. And so when I was a teenager, I was involved with the very early days of a big band, the Northside Big Band, and I did actually play flute in that in the beginning with a person some of your listeners may know, Tim Rollinson. He's a guitar player who was in the band Dig, and he and I were the flute section in the big band. Then I finished high school in Singapore, and I did play jazz gigs in Singapore. But when I say I was very, like, a lot of influences, I was also in the Singapore Philharmonic playing flute, and I was also studying erhu in a Chinese orchestra.
Right.
Not very well.
Well, you can't do everything well. That wouldn't be fair. Was there ever a suggestion that playing jazz was an unsuitable job for a woman?
I wondered if we were going to talk about this, and I'm glad you've asked this question, because I would say back when I was in a sort of development phase, I guess you'd say it was the late 70s, early 80s, and I do feel things have changed a lot since then. Certainly in Australia, the culture's very, very different now. I never received any resistance or lack of encouragement from other people, and I have to say particularly my family have always been extremely supportive. And I think that's when, back at that time, I suppose there may have been some more unspoken feeling that maybe, you know, not so much that it was not a good thing for a woman to do, but nobody had just heard that many women doing it. So no one really had in their mind, well, is this something that women can do? You know, not meaning it in any derogatory sense, but just the mental image wasn't there for people. So I guess there was some degree of disbelief, but not, I wouldn't say discouragement, no.
No, no, because I mean, when you make a list of the great jazz musicians of the past, there are lots of women there, of course, but they're all singers.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area, and it is one that has become of great interest to me, to the point where it's become a bit of a mission for me to try to encourage young women into the jazz scene, because I know that there's a lot of women who really do want to be there. And the thing is, any jazz musician pretty much will tell you, I know you've had an amazing collection of them on this show, it's just such an amazing thing to do. It's so much fun. It's so creative. It's so spontaneous. The people in the scene are generally really amazing. So it became a bit of a passion for me to want to share that, so that to help other women build their confidence, because I think that's all it comes down to, really.
It's a funny area, isn't it? And in some ways it gets funnier with every passing year, because jazz is, once upon a time, I suppose around about the 1940s, it was the pop music of the day in the era of the swing bands. And now it's become something, sadly, quite rarefied. Or is it sad? Should it be rarefied, do you think, jazz?
Jazz is in such an interesting position because it, well, for one thing, it's even hard to talk about jazz as a thing because it means so many different things now. It still exists in that 1940s kind of sense. You know, you can still go to an RSL club somewhere in Sydney and hear a big band and see people dancing to it and have it as kind of entertainment music. You know, not even with people only of that generation, but younger people are appreciating that. And again, I mean, I think it comes back to the bebop era. I think that was where the history of jazz started to change and it became less accessible for the non-specialist listener. So perhaps that division was inevitable. But I think it's still a very accessible music once you can get people there. I think you could say that about a lot of music. I think you could say that about a lot of contemporary classical music too. You know, when things get thrown in the too hard basket by the media or education system or who knows why, then it's a shame. I agree. It is a shame if it just becomes this sort of rarefied thing in its own little bubble.
Particularly because it seems to me that Australia has produced, well, over 50 years, but particularly in the last 10, 20 years, some of the most amazing jazz musicians.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
I suspect that there is an enormous percentage of musical talent in Australia is actually in jazz. That some of those players I find quite astonishing.
Oh, it is really extraordinary the extent to which we have a high degree of skill, but beyond that, a really high degree of creative concept in the music. I would agree. I think Australia is a standout, in fact.
Any theories about why?
Well, I think the education system is part of it. I think we've got very good jazz courses in all our capital cities. And then another one of my theories, I don't know if it's true, is that we have a certain freedom here that has perhaps allowed people to find their own voices a little more easily than in some other places, because we don't have the weight of tradition breathing down our neck.
Don't have Wynton Marsalis.
That helps.
Breathing down your neck, telling you can't do that. It's not jazz.
Yeah, yeah. So people have been free to, like, they've got good education, which has given them amazing sort of skill on their instruments and knowledge of the music, which has sort of given them the tools to then go on and develop their own ideas about the music. That's a theory. I don't know if that's
well. You did the course at the New South Wales Con, as it then was, the Sydney Conservatorium, the jazz course there. In a way, it still seems odd that there should be, you know, an academic training in jazz. Jazz is the sort of thing that you ought to be able to work out how to do on your own or not at all. But it's become absolutely the norm around the world. Are there any drawbacks, do you think?
I think there are drawbacks, yeah, in that if it becomes fossilised, you know, if it becomes that this is the way that you play jazz, because in an institution you have to be able to judge what people are doing. So you need to be able to say, okay, can you do your 251s? Can you do your Coltrane changes? Can you do this? Can you do that? And then tick, okay, you pass your exam. And in some sense, that effort of passing the exam is against the spirit of what Charlie Parker did, because he didn't sort of look at what Lester Young had done and said, okay, I'll do the same thing. He went, I love Lester Young, so I'm going to learn what he did and then I'm going to do my own thing with it, which is the ultimate goal of jazz, I think. But having said that, I think that just comes down to the wisdom of the teachers. And fortunately, we have incredible teachers at our jazz courses by and large, and so they're actually hip to that. So I don't think that in general we're falling into that trap. The unfortunate thing is, I mean, you're right, you wouldn't need a jazz course if you could go to a gig every night, sit in, learn from the guy next to you how to do it. And that's how, like, for example, someone like John Poche learned essentially to play jazz, because there are a lot more gigs around. So I think that's the downside, is that young people don't have the opportunities to play and to sit in that kind of mentorship situation as much as people did, you know, say in the 50s or 60s. And I do worry, you know, on behalf of young musicians, that the actual career opportunities are extremely difficult for them.
Yes, that's right. They have this talent, they have this fantastic training, but what are they going to do?
Yeah, yeah, they have to be extremely self-motivated, really, to make a career out of it, which has always been the case.
Yes. Well, you're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. My guest is Sandy Evans, OAM. And you've been extremely self-motivated because, I mean, you play in the Sandy Evans Trio. You've been a member of Clarion Fracture Zone, the new ensemble Jazz State, which you formed with Tony Gorman, the Indian jazz fusion group Citizens of Earth, played with Ten Part Invention. You mentioned John Poche, the Catholics, the Australian Art Orchestra. I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg. I mean, I will just... You know, lists make for very boring radio, so I won't go on, but I could go on. And that's partly, I suppose, making a living, but it's also a huge variety of music just in what I've mentioned, and that's important too?
Yes, it's interesting. I'd had a break from universities and institutions for about 30 years, and I'm back at one at the moment, studying and doing a lot of reading about music, and I'm reading about my period in a way, and I'm discovering that trend that you see in me, this diversity, this eclecticism, I think it's very typical of the modern musician. It's our joy and it's our dilemma, because having the knowledge and the intelligence and the wisdom, I suppose, to know how to negotiate all these different areas and not just be a bit of a jack of all trades, master of none, or how to find your own voice in all these different situations. Very, very challenging. But I love it. I love it. I couldn't imagine being any other way. I feel incredibly privileged to be in this position.
And do the various areas of your musical activity bleed into each other?
They do in some surprising ways. And in some ways, they also don't. Certainly, recently, what has really motivated me to look deeper into Indian music is to gain greater control with rhythm in particular. And I found that initially, my study in that area made me a very, very, very bad Indian musician, but would pop up quite unexpectedly in a jazz solo without me thinking about it at all. And I noticed all sorts of relationships when I was listening to jazz as well, for example, with the great tenor saxophone player Sonny Rollins. As I was listening to him one day, I suddenly recognised a pattern I'd been looking at in Indian music. And I went, that's incredible. You know, there's that, it was like a six and a four and a six starting on the last beat of the bar. So it's a thing you might hear a lot in jazz just because it's syncopation. Mm. But suddenly my focus, my awareness of listening to jazz was sharpened by this insight into rhythm. So I have a lot of experiences like that.
How did you get into Indian music?
Well, it was something I'd always been interested in, probably from growing, like living in Singapore as a teenager. Then I travelled to India in that backpacker period I was talking about. I wanted to be a filmmaker, and I actually worked for a short time as an assistant director on a, what do they call it nowadays, Chollywood movie in Chennai. So I always had an interest in it, but I resisted delving into it as a performer because it seemed too daunting for a long time, and I felt I needed to really find my feet as a jazz musician. Then what prompted me to get deeper into it in recent times has been the Australian Art Orchestra's collaboration with Guru Karakudi Armani.
This is The Theft of Sita.
After that. Or no, actually before that. So The Theft of Sita was a different project that was with Balinese Galan.
Oh, sorry, of course it was, yes.
Yeah, this was the first recording we did with the Art Orchestra was Into the Fire, and then we've recently released the Chennai tapes, they're called. And I think we started collaborating with them in 1996, and then we did a number of workshops where the idea was for us to just get a bit more of a handle on how they were thinking, how their system worked. The real time where I started to go much deeper into it was we went on a relatively small group tour led by Adrian Sheriff, bass trombonist from Melbourne, very, very fine musician who studied Carnatic music for a long time. And on that tour, I was in a horn section of Adrian playing bass trombone, Scott Tinkler playing trumpet, and an Indian classical musician, B.V. Balasai, playing flute. And on that tour, it was another one of these eureka moments where the combination of these extraordinary players led me to see how Indian music could provide some structure for me in improvising, especially in modal improvising, which I love, that I felt I was searching for. And Scott is very, very advanced in his rhythmic thinking. It's one of the things he's really focused on, but he hasn't done it in a way that is at all traditional in relation to Indian music. His approach is much more chromatic and intervallic based. Balasai was playing with raga, and I felt that I'm sort of somewhere in between. I actually do love raga and the feeling of staying in one area for a long time. I was seduced by that as well. So was that powerful combination of players that prompted me to go, hey, there's something here for me.
Yes. Well, once you get into a mode, it's actually rather hard to get out again, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's right. You could stay there forever, and it's the most beautiful feeling. It's what you said before, sound. Once you get into that sound, and of course on a wind instrument you have that beautiful feeling that's generated by breath. It's magic. You don't want to stop, that's for sure.
Thank you. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National, and I'm talking to Sandy Evans. Let's talk a little more about the different approaches that you take to, well, I'm going to come and use that word jazz again, although I do notice in your biography that you studiously avoid it most of the time, and I can see why, given your Indian experiences alone. But playing in a trio as opposed to playing in Ten-Part Invention, as opposed to playing in the art orchestra, very, very different experiences, or is it simply a matter of how many colleagues you've got around you at any given time?
Oh, no, very different. Each one of those is very, very different. Ten-Part Invention has been incredibly important to me, I think, especially as a composer. That's where I really got to cut my teeth as a jazz composer. And I had people I really admired, other composers like Roger Frampton and Miroslav Bukovsky, that was in the early days of the band. And so I was hearing their compositions and being able to place mine in sort of some relationship to theirs and get their feedback about what I was doing. And most importantly, to get my music played. I mean, that's a challenge for any composer, and I had a group willing to play it, you know, a 10-piece group, which is, of course, economically not easy to sustain. So in a group like Ten-Part Invention, the playing is obviously very important, and the nice thing about Ten-Part Invention is it's a balance between a large ensemble and a small group. So it's small enough that you can still feel when you're playing with the rhythm section that same interaction that is so essential, I think, to the trio context. But then you've got this larger range of forces to use as a composer to express your ideas. So Ten-Part, I guess, is in the middle of those two groups, as you would expect through the size, I suppose. The trio, I mean, for one thing, in the trio, you play a lot more. It sounds obvious, but, you know, you pretty much play all night, which is, I guess that's like the ultimate challenge and joy, really, because you have to be inventive for a long period of time and with a lot of different pieces. So I really, really, really love that, and I'm really enjoying the way that I've got a trio at the moment with Brett Hurst and Toby Hall, and it's really feeling very good. And that's very different, again, from the Australian Art Orchestra. The Australian Art Orchestra, I think, probably would struggle the most with calling itself a jazz group. I mean, Paul Grabowski, the leader of the group, has often said that, you know, he doesn't like to use the word jazz in relation to Australian music, and particularly with the Art Orchestra, I think it is problematic, although sometimes we do projects that are within, you know, very much within the jazz tradition. But it's more about, well, it could be absolutely anything. It could be music by people more associated with contemporary classical music. It could be rock. It could be electronic music. And then the group has also done a lot of cross-cultural collaborations. There's one that I'm not involved in with musicians from Arnhem Land. And then I have been involved with, obviously, the Indian one and also musicians from Bali. So the Asian connection is also very strong with the group. So I think it's a very, very innovative ensemble, the Australian Art Orchestra, and it varies in size nowadays. It's not like an orchestra that's the same every time it gets together. So it's a very, it's grown into a very flexible group away from the sort of big band model that it started on. So you can't generalize about what would happen when there's an art orchestra concert. You know, as a player, you just have to go with a totally open mind. And sometimes, I think the last performance I did was the Miles Davis tribute, and Paul Grabowski had transcribed a Miles solo for me, the violinist and the guitar player, to play. So that was a totally different experience again.
Yes. What about Sandy Evans, the composer? When you're writing, well, you're talking about writing for Ten-Part Invention, you've composed for all sorts of ensembles. Is this also something which begins with sound?
Yes. Sound, and I guess the other thing that's important to me is the person making the sound. It's hard to separate those two, but I'm very much a composer who writes with a particular player in mind. So in the case of Ten-Part Invention, there's a piece I wrote called North Pole, which features Bernie McGann and James Greening. And both of those players have such a distinctive sound. And I couldn't have written that piece without, like, of course I didn't know what they were going to play, but I could imagine their sound. And knowing their sound, I could think of a way in which to provide a framework for them. So I struggle if I have to sit down and write a piece not knowing who's going to play it. I find that much, much more difficult. And in fact, in that instance, I would probably imagine someone that I knew and use them as my model.
And does the player's personality come into it as well, or is that inseparable from their sound?
Oh, gosh, that's such an interesting area. I've thought about this quite a lot, and it's interesting because sometimes the sweetest sounding musicians, I mean, have a reputation as being the most, I won't swear on national radio, but you know, they're not very nice people.
Yes, yeah.
So it's really, really hard to say.
Yes.
I try to avoid that because I think it can get you into some really difficult areas, you know, and I suppose I'm particularly sensitive to it because of the stereotyping of what women sound like. And, you know, like, oh, she's a very nice girl, you know, she must play very sweet little things. And, you know, I think it's limiting. So I might be inspired by somebody's personality, but I think, yeah, it's hard to say how that connects with the sound that they make. Having said that, though, I think our expression as musicians ultimately does reflect our spirit. So I'm kind of contradicting myself there, but it is a contradiction that I see around me in the world, so I can't avoid it.
Yes, yes, and just because somebody's a bastard doesn't mean they can't play beautifully, of course.
That's right. There's many examples of that. It really used to mess me up.
I'd like to ask you about Gestate. Mm. Now, this is an interesting project which could go in all sorts of different directions and does, and I'm sure will continue to. This was you and Tony Gorman who had the idea for it, was it?
That's right. I'm married to Tony, and we had a band together with Alistair Spence that you mentioned earlier, yeah. Clarion Fracture Zone, which was a very important group to all of us. Then in 1997, Tony was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and it became difficult for him to continue to function the way he had been as a professional musician. Rather than continue on with Clarion Fracture Zone, we decided to put that on the shelf because we wanted to, it was sort of very much about him, Alistair and I, and we didn't want to sort of just cut him out of it and have that, it was very painful for us to stop it, but it felt like the right thing. So, but it meant Tony and I weren't actually doing any creative projects together, and that was something we loved. And over time, we began thinking about another group where Tony could be involved conceptually and as a composer, and we came up with the idea for Gestate. It also came out of my relationship with the koto player Satsuki Odomura. I play in a world music trio with her and percussionist Tony Lewis, and Satsuki and I have become very good friends. And this is actually an interesting example of what we were just talking about, because it's my relationship with Satsuki and her sound that made me think that Gestate could work, because I couldn't have imagined, you know, just, oh, I'll look up the yellow pages and get a koto player.
Yes, yes.
But because I knew what some of Satsuki's skills and sounds were, I could imagine a way to bring her into a slightly more of a jazz environment. And because of Satsuki being there, I really wanted other musicians who would be sensitive to her aesthetic. And, of course, the drummer Simon Barker has a long association both with Japan but more specifically with Korean music, which is, of course, different from Japanese, but I knew that he was going to be a fantastic person to interact with Satsuki, and that certainly proved to be the case. Then bass player Steve Elphick has a similar breadth of knowledge. And Tony and I both love writing for horns and particularly clarinets. So we chose to incorporate Paul Cutlan, who's a fabulous bass clarinet and E-flat clarinet and B-flat clarinet, as well as a very talented saxophonist as well. And then trumpeter Phil Slater, who I think is just an unbelievable musician on every level. And we have guitarist Carl Dewhurst, who's a very diverse musician who can create a soundscape, or who can play a groove, or who can play a bebop solo, can play in any timing, can play in pretty much anything you want and sound like Carl Dewhurst. And then computers as well with Greg White. So this was an extraordinary pool of musicians and great improvisers, every single one of them, to draw from. Very, very inspiring. We're sort of working on our next project at the moment, which is going to relate to the love of food.
Well, that's something we can all relate to, I think. How has living with Tony's MS affected you as a musician?
Initially, I think I was in a state of shock for a couple of years. What did happen in those initial years was I became unbelievably grateful that I could play. You know, when you're watching somebody go through intense pain of having to stop doing what they love, every chance you get to play, you just go, I'm so fortunate to be able to do this. I still feel that way now. I still watch him, you know, struggle to feel the keys or whatever, and I go, I'm so lucky to be able to do this. So it certainly has made me appreciate my life and my ability to exist in music way beyond what I could have imagined. And then it has been really tough, especially I'd say in the first 5 or 6 years, because suddenly I had to make a lot more money, for one thing, and then I was dealing with my grief at watching on my own level and watching him. Anyway, musically, I've recently written a piece called When the Sky Cries Rainbows, and the whole focus of this piece was for me to try to express what I'd gone through in that journey. And that was played for the first time last year, and it will be recorded by the ABC. And that's for my trio with some guests. The guests are Alistair Spence, Phil Slater and James Greening. And I chose the imagery of rainbows for that piece, even though it's very hippie, but because I thought it expressed the idea of hope that can come out of suffering, which has been a big theme for Tony also.
Oh yeah, well, he's talked about it on this program, of course.
That's right. And I think that message is so profound for us as human beings, because it's at times in most of our lives we do face suffering. You know, hopefully, you know, for most people it's not as intense as ours has been, but I mean we can't avoid it. It's there. We're all going to die. And the idea that there is a hope within that, I think, is very, very important. And so I wanted to just sort of do my best to express that through this imagery and this journey.
What will we listen to from Gestate to finish with?
Maybe Winter Flight, because that was probably the start. Yeah, Winter Flight was the start of expressing that feeling. It's a Gestate piece where I was fascinated by the long migration of birds and the idea that winter is a kind of barren and scary time, but leads to this kind of change, this idea of being able to migrate somewhere where different things are going to happen. So it starts with a very cold landscape, and then it's about the sort of emotional release of moving on, going into flight out of that landscape.
Sandy Evans, thank you very much indeed for being my guest on today's music show.
Thank you, Andrew. It really is a privilege.
And there's music by Sandy Evans, Winter Flight, that is. It comes from the album Kaleidoscope by the band Gestate, and it's on the Tall Poppies label. And that conversation with Sandy Evans was from October 2010. If you're interested in a recording of When the Sky Cries Rainbows, I suggest you go to Sandy Evans' website, sandyevans.com.au, and you can organise yourself a copy of it there. All of these links are on the music show's website, of course. If you go to the Sound Lounge in Sydney tonight, you'll hear Sandy Evans. She's there with her sextet, and they're playing excerpts from When the Sky Cries Rainbows and some new work, and new works by Alistair Spence and James Greening as well. It's part of the Sydney International Women's Jazz Festival. There's a link on our website for that too. Tomorrow, Sandy Evans flies to India with the Australian Art Orchestra's Two Oceans Ensemble. They're playing for the Hindu Fest, and the concert includes the premiere of a new collaborative suite, Meetings at the Table of Time, that she has co-written with Guru Karakudimani. Karakudimani. I always have difficulty saying his name. We're going to go out today with their last collaboration, the album Cosmic Waves. And this week's music show was produced by Maureen Cooney and Penny Lomax. Technical production from Jenny Parsonage, Tim Simons, Richard Gervin and Paul Penton. Next week on the music show, the composer Nigel Butterley.